All right, this is Congress Two Beers In, and I am here delighted to have Dave Hopkins join the podcast. Dave is an associate professor at Boston College. He is the author of multiple books, which include Asymmetric Politics, which is co-authored with Matt Grossman, and Red Fighting Blue, which explains how culture war and winner-take-all politics produced a regionally divided electorate. If that doesn't give you enough to read, he also publishes a weekly column about current political events at Bloomberg Opinion. All around smart guy and great guy. Happy to have you join the pod, Dave.
Thanks, Josh. It's really great to be here.
So one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on is I have been fascinated by what's been going on with the parties. They are in a weird place. Right? They seem to be developing right before our eyes and evolving right before our eyes. How would you describe the state of the parties, just kind of like generally speaking right now in the US?
There are things we can say about the parties in general, and then I think there are things we can say about each of the parties separately. I think in general terms, obviously we're in an age where there is a lot of strong partisanship in the electorate and in government. I'm old enough to have started school back in the waning days when people were saying the parties were getting weaker. And obviously that's no longer the case. But the fact that we have all this polarization doesn't mean that we don't have change. When people describe partisanship today, they sort of describe it as if everybody's kind of firmly planted in one camp or the other. They're on team red or team blue sort of perpetually, and they are not open to any, influence from the other side. But we're seeing a continued evolution in both parties' coalitions. We're seeing a change, for example, in the relationship of educational attainment to partisanship in this country, with especially among whites, with better educated whites more likely to become Democrats than they were 20 years ago, and whites without college degrees more likely to be Republicans. So there is this sort of stasis of strong partisanship, but there's also this continuing evolution that's going on as well. And I think when we're looking at how the parties are behaving in government, we're seeing both of those things play out in government as well, and in Congress certainly. Strong partisanship, but also changing constituencies that are affecting both sides.
This is one of the things that's kind of been teasing my brain a little bit. Something that I haven't fully been able to explain is we have very polarized parties. I don't think there's any question about that. They really dislike each other and they very much disagree with one another. So they're very distant. And one of the things that typically people assume that when the two parties are so divided and they so much dislike the other side, is that they would be sort of more similar, right? More homogenous, more together when it came to policy proposals, when it came to like what they want to accomplish with government control. But right now we also seem to see a lot of intra-party disagreement, right? Fighting among Republicans and fighting among Democrats. So, I mean, I don't know how you want to take this, but how do we square this sort of like intra-party consternation with intra-party consternation with inter-party polarization? Why is it taking 15 ballots to elect a Speaker of the House, for example? That just seems a bit odd.
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually think this is an example of where the parties are a bit different, because I would say the Republicans are the more divided party than the Democrats. And especially if we think about how the Democrats were historically, they're more unified now than they used to be, because they've, in part because of this constituency change, they've sort of shed the old line Southern rural blue dog type wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, that's disappearing. And, nowadays when people talk about how much the Democrats are able to do in Congress with their narrow majorities, and they sort of credit Pelosi and Biden for, shepherding the party together. Well, Pelosi and Biden did part of that, but really the voters did a lot of that by getting rid of the old line, Democrats that used to be kind of the dissidents. So you still obviously have some party divisions, but you also have, I think, probably more unity compared to what you used to have on the Democratic side. And on the Republican side, I guess, a lot of this disunity, it's hard to say it's all about policy differences. It's not really that we have more ideological variety in the Republican Party than we used to either. I mean, they have also lost their moderates mostly from office. But there are lots of disagreements over tactics and governing style and priority that I think we really saw play out with the speaker's race. You know, it's not so much that, you know, Matt Gaetz or Lauren Boebert have all these policy disagreements with people like Kevin McCarthy. They have a lot of disagreements about sort of like how the party should govern and how aggressive it should be in kind of confronting Democrats. And that's the nature of a lot of the fight these days on the Republican side. I think to put it all as an ideological disagreement, I think kind of oversimplifies things in a way. I think it's a disagreement that runs also to sort of their vision of how you're supposed to use power when you get it. And of course, the way that McCarthy was able to kind of cobble together the support to get the speakership was less by making a lot of policy concessions than it was about making a lot of power concessions.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that is, you know, that you were just mentioning how Democrats used to have this sort of like regional rural divide. And so like the kind of priorities that you would get in those constituencies would differ from the national party. And so you'd get this kind of stalemate when it came to like major policy proposals. The Republican dissidents, for lack of a better word, seem different, right? And you just mentioned, is there like a regional component to it, like there was in the Democratic Party, or is it just sort of like scattered across the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, they tend to be mostly from safe Republican seats, right? They're pretty red seats with, you know, with one or two exceptions. You know, Boebert had a close call, obviously, in the last election. But most of these guys come from very conservative constituencies, but there are also people from equally conservative constituents who don't act the way they do. So I think there's a limit to how much, yeah, geography or constituency itself just can kind of predict whether you're a Freedom Caucus Republican or a more, you know, McCarthy, Paul Ryan style Republican. It sort of is just, you know, who did the primary voters, you know, in that district nominate in the Republican Party? And did they nominate someone of that kind of more confrontational bent or someone of the more, for lack of a better word, establishment style? There doesn't seem to be a clear way to just look at characteristics of those districts and set them apart from characteristics of the other districts held by Republicans.
So do you think that this is going to be an ongoing thing? Are they going to grow in numbers? Is this sort of like just a fleeting sort of one-off, like idiosyncratic development that we've been watching?
Well, I try to shy away from predicting because I'm not necessarily great.
We're just going to make predicting.
But it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I mean, one of the fascinating things about thus the last, you know, couple of months of Republican politics on the Hill is how much it sort of seems like a throwback to the 2011 through 2015 era, right? So, you know, with the Trump era kind of as the exception. And one of the things I think that happened there was that, you know, Trump caused a lot of headaches in a lot of ways for congressional Republicans, but there was one thing he did that was kind of useful, which is that when Trump was sort of around, fights within the party tended to be fights about Trump. And the rhino hunters in the party who were looking to start fights about ideological purity had clear targets, which were the anti-Trump Republicans. And if you were a sort of regular, you know, kind of median House Republican, that meant that sort of if you embraced Trump and you didn't go after Trump, Trump could sort of protect you from challenges from the right, and you sort of had your conservative card punched. And the people who were in trouble were the, you know, the Jeff Flakes and Liz Cheneys of the world. They were the people who were sort of the targets. Now that Trump is no longer as salient, the sort of the dividing line within the Republican Party, we're sort of moving back to the era when it was the Freedom Caucus versus everybody else. And that means the dividing line is different. And it means that the sort of the average Republican is now on the side of maybe feeling a little more vulnerable, that they're going to get attacked from the right. And so we have these dynamics that are somewhat reminiscent of the Boehner era kind of reappearing after the period when everything was all about Trump.
Yeah. Now, the Republican Party has been interesting. I mean, like, one of the things that they were really trying to jump upon, and particularly this past midterm, was inflation and the economy, as in it was sort of like very unsettled. Biden's approvals weren't very great. They've gotten back into power and they've sort of gotten right back into those kind of culture war topics, right? We're going after the pandemic. We're going after immigration, some of these other things those are like the big votes that have been happening since they've taken power. Do you think that this is really the crux of their coalition at the moment, right? In other words, are they really limited to those sorts of topics?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there's a sort of a distinction between the issues that they kind of think they can run on that are, you know, sort of successful general election issues that can attract swing voter support versus the issues that they use to kind of satisfy more the base of the party. And inflation was obviously an issue that, you know, lots of people were concerned about. You didn't have to be a Republican to be concerned about. It was a sound issue to campaign on in 2022. But now that the election is over, especially because there's still divided government, Democrats have the Senate and the White House, there's only so much they're going to be able to deliver on actual conservative policy under divided government. And so you're worried that, again, your base starts to get antsy, that you're not, you know, you're not doing enough. So these kind of symbolic issues and symbolic votes in the House, I think, play a very useful role politically for the House Republicans to be able to sort of take to the base of their party. And of course, another thing is the oversight power, you know, the investigations of Hunter Biden and the Homeland Security Department and that sort of thing. Those are also going to be obviously used in part to you know, to serve as base satisfaction initiatives during this next session of Congress. So I think it's partially about sort of who are you appealing to with each of your, you know, each of your priorities and each of your choices.
How much of the Republican Party now and how much of the developments that you see do you think are because of Trump, right? Is there anything that is happening right now within the Republican Party that is unique because Trump was on the scene, or do you see these as sort of just longstanding conservative grievances?
Well, the way I see Trump is that, you know, Trump is a cause, but he's also an effect. And I think sometimes we talk about Trump like Trump sort of dropped out of the sky, you know, and just sort of like
like his presidential announcement, right? Coming down on the golden
escalator. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. He descended on an elevator out of the clouds, you know, to sort of remake American politics. And of course, there's an extent to which that's true. And, you know, nomination politics always has a certain random chaotic element to it that just sort of shakes things up unpredictably. But it's also the case that, you know, I think it's fair to say that a Trump type of figure would not necessarily have been as successful in the Republican Party at some previous era of our politics, that there were things already happening that laid the groundwork for Trump to be successful. And we were already very much moving in the direction of cultural issues becoming a big flashpoint between the parties. We were already moving towards a kind of a more populist streak in conservative politics. And we were already going towards this era where conservative media was stoking a lot of dissatisfaction with the traditional leadership of the Republican Party. And all of those things really laid the groundwork for Trump. And even, you know, the stuff I'm, you know, interested in now in terms of my own research, as we've touched on before, the diplomacy divide, the fact that, you know, people with college educations are moving to the Democrats and whites without college degrees are more likely to be Republicans. That trend was already in place before Trump arrived. Now, Trump kind of supercharged it once he did arrive, but he didn't start it. That was something that was already in motion that sort of made his rise possible, because the college educated voters who are sort of the most resistant to Trump were already kind of starting to leave the Republican Party even before he arrived, and the white working class supporters were already moving in the Republican direction. So yeah, I think of him both as cause and effect. I think obviously had he not gotten the nomination, had he not become president, there would be things that would be different, but I'm not sure we would be still in the, you know, in the 90s either. I think that the whole response to the Obama presidency and how that has worked through and transformed Republican politics, again, that was something that was already happening before Trump. And Trump, you know, one of the reasons he had his success was he spent a lot of time watching Fox learning about what it was that Republican voters cared about and how best to sort of present himself to that electorate. He was jumping on something that was already in motion to some degree.
So I wanted to get your opinion on this. What is the relationship between the Republican Party and conservative media as you see it right now? There's a lot of talk that they're like much more integrated than before, that conservative media is often like in charge of the party in ways that are kind of unusual or unnatural given political history. Mm-hmm. How do you see the relationship?
I think we can see conservative media, major conservative media, as sort of a component of the Republican Party, a center of power within Republican politics. And as you know, political scientists have spent a lot of time thinking about like, what is a party? What, you know, how do we define a party? Who's in the party? Who's out of the party? Is the party just the people in office with that label? Is it a bigger set of people than that? And I tend to subscribe to the idea of a fairly broad definition of a party, that a party can include people who aren't formally credentialed members of the party or hold an office within the party, but they can still be very influential within the party, and they can play sort of the role of a party actor, a party leader. And I would say Sean Hannity, for example, would qualify, even though he doesn't have an office at the Republican National Committee or a seat, you know, in the Republican Conference in Congress. He does things like recruit candidates for office. He does things like pressure party members to take particular positions on issues.
Does things like text people on January 6th in the White House.
Well, yeah. And you know, one of the things we saw during the Trump presidency was even just at the personal level, how integrated the Republican Party in government was with the conservative media. You know, these people were all talking to each other, you know, and that was throughout the 4 years of Trump's presidency that was happening. You had people going right from Fox News into the White House, like Bill Shein or John Bolton. So that to me seems like they're part of the party and they're an important part of the party. Now, they don't always get their way and they don't agree with everyone else in the party, and they're one element, you know, of a broader set of institutions. But there's no doubt in my mind that they are that you can't understand Republican politics without paying a lot of attention to what Republican media is up to, and that's another way that their parties are different. I mean, there's liberal media, there's MSNBC, there's liberal websites, but they don't play anything like the role within the Democratic Party that Fox plays within the Republican Party. And the individual actors don't have anything like the influence. And they don't use their influence in the same way to kind of, you know, try to direct the direction of the party and the decisions made by the party office holders nearly to the extent that Fox does. So I sort of say, yeah, we should think of them as part of the party and a significant part of the party. That's my view on it.
All right. Well, speaking of people who text presidents, let's talk about a president who maybe doesn't text. what do you think of the Biden presidency and what he's been doing? He kind of ran on this odd campaign, right, of bipartisanship, especially when, you know, everybody's talking about winning elections through mobilization, through animating your base, getting your voters to turn out. President Biden came in talking about unifying the country. He has not succeeded, but he did do a little bit more than people sort of expected. Where do you see his presidency right now? And what's happened the last 2 years? And what do you think will happen the next 2 years?
Well, as a party scholar, I think Joe Biden is a great personal walking, talking testament to the power of parties as institutions. He's had, a now more than 50-year career in Washington politics, and wherever the center of the Democratic Party at any given time in that 50 years has been, there's been Joe Biden. You know, when the party went through its tough on crime phase, there was Joe Biden being tough on crime. When its party went through its criminal reform phase, there's Joe Biden saying we should be reform. When it went through its tax cut phase, there he was voting for that. And his invade Iraq phase, he was for that. And then, you know, he has been flexible over his long career. And that is, I think, the secret to his success. And his presidency, I think, is a testament to kind of where the party is as of 2021, 2022. He's adapted himself to fit the demands that the major constituencies have had now in the party and the issues that they have wanted to prioritize: climate change, healthcare expansion, economic stimulus, and then, you know, some of these other things like infrastructure and, same-sex marriage. These are not necessarily the issues that Joe Biden has always dedicated his entire life to, but they are the issues that people who are influential in the Democratic Party now want him to do something about. Student loans is another example. And so he's doing, he's doing that. He's flexible, in order to, to sort of get and stay where he wants to be. He's willing to be flexible on that. And I think there was some, obviously there was some skepticism about whether he'd be able to deliver any bipartisan, support, but he managed to do that. And I don't know how much of the credit he gets. Some of these are just deals worked out, obviously, on the Hill, and sometimes the president, I'd say more than sometimes, the president gets too much credit for things that members of Congress are actually accomplishing. But one thing I do think that's relevant here is that Biden is our first president in a while who's not like a nationally, personally polarizing figure. He doesn't have the charisma, maybe, but also he doesn't sort of motivate the hatred that Trump did, that Obama did, that Bush did, and that Clinton did. I think you have to go back to George Bush Sr. to find another figure who sort of doesn't dominate the national landscape in the same way. And there are, of course, downsides to that, potentially. He doesn't, he's not an inspirational figure, inspiring a bunch of people to get into politics or whatever, the way other people were. But I think there's also a way in which that's worked to his benefit, in particular in some of these congressional deals, where peeling off enough Republicans in the Senate to get past a filibuster, to pass some of this legislation, is a lot easier when those Republicans don't feel like voting for anything that Joe Biden supports is like the kiss of death politically. And so the fact that he's kind of just not that same polarizing figure, that the attention isn't on him every day, that, there wasn't any national anti-Joe Biden movement that erupted in the 2022 midterms the way that, we've had almost every other midterm, lately. We've had like this national movement of people who hate the president that didn't happen this year.
Right.
I actually think that's kind of maybe an underestimated sort of like advantage in some ways for him, at least in getting legislation through and avoiding the big midterm backlash, is just that that people, their expectations for him aren't as high. It's been sort of easier for him to satisfy them, and he's just less polarizing. So the Republicans have been able to sort of deal a little bit more with him. And that's another kind of, he's a retro figure in so many ways. And it's not just because, he doesn't text and he doesn't, he doesn't do Twitter or whatever, but it's like also like he doesn't, he's not one of these like dominating the figures the way that we've sort of been used to lately in the White House.
Do you see the Republican Party as like unified behind any one particular economic idea? Right. I mean, one of the things that's fascinated me is watching Democrats sort of like fight over this. Like you have the progressives who are a little bit more socially liberal, but like a lot of people who claim to be progressive really aren't that economically progressive in the same vein as like Bernie Sanders or AOC. Do you see a similar type of divide within the Republican Party? Are like tax cuts basically the default mechanism that they always kind of go back to? Because we're talking about a lot of spending cuts currently, and it seems like the party's divided between, okay, well, we want spending cuts in order to raise the debt ceiling. And a lot of Republicans are like, hey, spending cuts means like not entitlements. It means not defense. It means not VA. It means all these other things. It means the other discretionary part of the pile. And then you've got the kind of like very, very conservative folks who are like, no, it means everything. Like on the discretionary side, everything, and maybe even entitlements. Do you think that divide, do you think there is a divide there, or what are the big cleavages that you see when you see politicians campaigning on these issues?
Yeah, I think this is very typical for Republicans, which is that tax cuts unify the party and spending cuts divide the party. I think that's a dynamic that goes back a long, long way in Republican politics. And of course, part of the reason for that is public opinion. Tax cuts are a lot more popular than spending cuts are, and especially when you're talking about the actual stuff the government spends money on rather than the wasteful stuff people think the government spends a lot of money on. If you look at where the money actually is, right, in the budget, it's overwhelmingly in very popular domestic social programs, or it's in defense, where of course Republicans have a commitment to protect spending. So that goes back just to a long-standing quirk in American public opinion, which is that Americans mostly tend to be for smaller government in the abstract and more conservative values in the abstract. But once you get into the policy specifics of what that means in terms of shrinking government means cutting entitlements, domestic discretionary spending, then the support, you know, the majority support goes away. And so the Republicans have always had this tension between people who really are, I think, sincerely in a lot of ways, ideologically committed to cutting spending, and certain constituencies in the party, the base of the party at the interest group level, that are ideologically and sincerely committed to cutting spending. And that anyone who has to run in a district where they might have any kind of competition in the next election, that gets really, really cold feet about actually voting to cut spending, you know, in reality. And that's why, of course, spending doesn't ever tend to get cut, no matter whether it's Democrats or Republicans in charge. It doesn't happen fundamentally because of the worry of a backlash from voters, that voters don't actually want that, even when they say they want a smaller government, even they say they want a smaller deficit, that they actually won't put up with what you need to do to get that. And so that's a very old dilemma for Republicans. And you know, they've tried to find ways out of it over the years by, you know, well, we're for spending cuts, but we'll let the future Congress actually decide what gets cut, or have to, you know, have their fingerprints on it. Obviously, this year with the debt ceiling, let's try to force the Democrats to go along, you know, and therefore kind of share the pain if there's backlash to it. But that's, you know, that's sort of a long-standing issue for Republicans that sort of goes all the way back in the party. And so in that sense, it's not much different from the way it's always been.
So it's old politics that's been going on. Do you think it's creating new cleavages though, right? I mean, this seems to be one of the issues that's really causing foment among the right wing, particularly in the House, right? I think you wrote a piece not too long ago that said like, the House rebels have a point, right? Which is essentially this, like, they haven't cut spending and they haven't done any of the things that they said they were going to do. Do you think this is causing new tension within the coalition?
Maybe. I think that there is a tension. You know, one of the things I think we've seen over the years since the Budget Control Act is that there's a sort of a tension. One of the tension in the coalition is people who want to cut spending number one priority versus people who care more about defense spending and are willing to trade more domestic spending in exchange for more defense spending. And the way, of course, it's worked out in practice is those people have sort of gained the upper hand because they've been able to cut a deal with the Democrats where there's more spending on both sides of the domestic versus military, divide. I can't tell whether anything's swinging back yet. I feel like it's too soon to see. Maybe we'll have more of a sense as things play out this year about whether the balance of power on the Republican side moves away from that now that defense spending has been raised as much as it's been in the last few years. Maybe there's more energy for trying to get tougher on it. But that seems to me a divide that maybe is not, I don't know how far back it goes, but certainly has been a divide that's characterized the last 10 years or so in Republican politics on the Hill.
One of the things that, let's talk about Democrats for a little bit, right? So yeah. We've got...
Everybody always talks about the Republicans all the time. So I'm happy to talk about the Democrats. The Democrats are interesting too, you know?
Yeah, that's right. Well, one of the things that's been happening in Democratic politics is I don't want to say mirrored, because, you know, conservatives have had like this wing of conservatism that's sort of like drawn the party to the right, and they've been increasingly trying to do that. And there's been a somewhat similar type of development within the progressive wing of the party. Talk to me about Democratic progressivism right now. Where do you see it? Is it growing? Is it having more influence? Is it having less influence? Like, obviously, there are very different styles of politics between progressives and conservatives, and at least the left wing and the right wing of the parties. But where do you see that, and how is it affecting Democrats?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do think it's stronger than it used to be. I do think we have a kind of identifiable progressive bloc, at least in the House. Senate is, you know, we have Sanders and Warren certainly in the Senate. But in the House, you can sort of see there's the squad, but then there's also the larger progressive, you know, caucus that I think are more important, you know, kind of as institutional players, maybe, you know, I don't know if you agree, but then we would have seen, say, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. It seems that that's the case. And it seems like they have, on some issues, been able to kind of pull the parties positions leftward, but they're more integrated into the party in general, I think, than you see on the Republican side. There isn't the sort of rift that pops up like you see the rift with Republicans. And their tactics are obviously very different. They don't kind of threaten regularly to sort of bring everything down if they don't get their way. At the end of the day, they like to, you know, they like to get things, they like to get a deal made. They like to want to be able to vote for something that actually passes. And this is one of the things that, you know, Matt and I in Asymmetric Politics sort of were very interested in arguing in terms of a difference between the parties, is that Democratic constituencies tend to prioritize productivity, you know, actual policy victories, and they're willing to compromise more to get something rather than nothing, even if they don't get everything they want. And so, yes, the progressives have had more influence, but also sometimes when they get, for example, presented with the Joe Manchin's, you know, reconciliation bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's sort of, well, you get this or nothing. Well, maybe you're not thrilled about it, but you'll vote yes. You'll vote for it. You want it to pass. You want something rather than nothing. And the Freedom Caucus, of course, is more likely to say, no, we'll tank something we don't like and cause trouble that way. So the Democrats are sort of gradual. There's more of a kind of a gradual evolution over time. You know, someone like Nancy Pelosi, you know, in her day was the progressive, you know, of vanguard of the party, and she became more kind of sort of closer to the median of the party as it evolved. So I do think that there's been that change, but the style of governing on the Democratic side has not really changed because of that. And the individual actors on the left, by and large, sort of want to maintain good relations with the leadership of the party and want to kind of bargain within the party in that way. And so far, that's sort of how they've approached things.
one of the, you know, do you see that? Do you see them evolving in a way that's a little more similar to the Freedom Caucus? The last 2 years, we saw them attempt to tank, or at least have threatened to tank, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act if they didn't get their Build Back Better agenda passed over the line. And that was one of the few moments that really tested Nancy Pelosi's leadership, where she had to kind of negotiate between her moderates and her progressive wing. And, you know, both were holding a gun to the other one's proposal. And, you know, I don't, how she pulled that off, I'm not really sure. There's some serious backroom negotiating. But it was one of the first times that you actually saw the progressive caucus say, like, we're willing to blow things up unless we get something that appeases us. Now, at the end of the day, they ultimately accepted the half loaf that they got from Manchin. But that August, September, October timeframe in the House of Representatives was really fraught. Do you see that kind of, do you see the potential for that to intensify moving forward if they continue to get more mobilized, more organized, and larger numbers in the House?
It could for sure. And sometimes they talk about adopting, I mean, AOC even recently sort of talked about, well, maybe we should adopt some of these tactics. Maybe these people are getting their way on the Republican side. But the problem, I think, is the downside risk that if it doesn't work out and you tank something and blow it up and get nothing, then I think the blowback in the Democratic Party of doing that is bigger than the blowback on the Republican side. And so they may try that in the future, but if it doesn't result in them getting a bill they like that then passes and becomes law, but it is sort of a, goes down in history as sort of a classic example of, you know, something, a tactic backfiring, and you get a bunch of interest groups mad at you that you tank the only thing that was a viable bill to pass, then that may not, in the long run, sort of gain popularity as a way to do things. So I think that they're going to be a little more careful about going too far down that road, I think, than the sort of analogous conservative purists in the Republican Party, who when they tank things sort of don't think it's necessarily a disaster.
Right. Although very well may could.
Yeah, well,
they want to take the debt ceiling, and it's like, I don't know that we want to go through that one. Yeah. In any event, one of the things that I wanted to mention, and I don't know if this overlaps with your new project that you've got coming, but it seems to me that you've got this weird sort of thing happening within the Democratic Party. On the one hand, you've got this sort of like anti-corporate progressivism, kind of anti-big business strand of politics is coming on, and has had some like reasonable popularity between Bernie Sanders and his run for presidency and AOC and various others. At the same time, Democrats have sort of consolidated all of their constituencies around major business hubs and corporate hubs. So what kind of tension is that going to cause Democrats moving forward? On the one side, we have this kind of growingly popular progressive wing, and on the other side, we've got like, you know, the Tom Carpers and the Chris Coons of Delaware and the Cory Bookers of New Jersey, who are very socially progressive, but on the economic side, maybe less so because they have constituencies that rely heavily on those corporations.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't really know. You know, there are always going to be tensions and disagreements in the parties. I mean, as much as the parties are not as factionalized maybe as they were 50 years ago, it's still a very big, diverse country with only two major parties. So there's just going to be, you know, inherently, there are going to be tensions there. I do think that, you know, it's not clear that the kind of Sanders style politics is likely to kind of be the dominant politics in the Democratic Party, but it may remain as a kind of a secondary style within the Democratic Party. And I think you're right that may set up a sort of a difference of opinion with Democrats who represent kind of affluent suburban districts that are where they have got a lot of workers in the private sector management and things like that, who are not really socialist revolutionaries. I expect that will be somewhat of a, of an area of difference. How deep the divide actually runs, I think, is going to be a function of whether any issues come up that can't be kind of compromised away in the party. So far, it doesn't seem like that has happened. But you know, it may happen in the future. You know, it's possible to overstate the rise of Bernie Sandersism within the Democratic Party. I mean, I think it is on the rise compared to how it used to be, but it's less clear to me how close or how far it is from really becoming a major part of Democratic politics. Biden so far seems to have done, you know, shown that it's a possibility to sort of keep those people reasonably satisfied, even if they're not thrilled with everything that he's doing or everything that he has and concerned about things he hasn't been able to accomplish. But we don't see any kind of real revolt or uprising either on the left against the current national leadership of the party. So it may be that those are divides that can be managed most of the time.
Yeah, and on the flip side, we've got Republican politics, which are increasingly anti-corporate, right? There's been sort of like the governor of Florida is attacking Disney World. You know, we have several politicians talking about woke business, and I'm sure it's already going to be hearings about this going on. Is this something that you're going to see? Is this populist strand of politics going to be more recognizably Republican going forward?
I think it's likely to be, yeah. You know, the corporate world, of course, at the management level has long been allied with the Republican Party on grounds of economic interest, and I think continue to will be allied on the grounds of economic interest. But of course, there's a lot of these other issues that aren't strictly economic issues that are becoming more important in our politics. And when you have a corporate sector that is increasingly led by well-educated urbanites who want to compete in a global market, who want to also compete domestically in a market of affluent, upscale, younger consumers, there are lots of purely market-based reasons to align yourself with you know, the sort of socially and culturally progressive causes, especially in the areas of race, gender, sexuality, et cetera. And if you want to attract workers who are college graduate professionals with left of center cultural sensibilities, you want your company to have a reputation for being socially enlightened, for being a good place to work if you're a woman or a person of color. And certainly if you're a company like Disney that is in the creative field, that is working with creative people, artists, actors, writers, musicians, people like that, who are clearly on the left side, you know, of any ideological spectrum you could define. Gosh, you know, there's a reason why you want to have the rainbow flags up during Pride Month, and you want to have corporate policies about, you know, diversity and inclusion. And the fact that then puts you at odds with the populist conservative strain of the Republican Party is seemingly just an inevitable conflict. It's going to change the relationship of both parties to the corporate world in a way that we're not familiar with growing up at a time when, well, you know, corporate America is part of the, you know, is part of the Republican coalition, and that's how it is. Things are going to get a lot more complicated, I think, because these corporate leaders are caught in this culture war that they didn't used to be part of. But it's not easy for them just to avoid it. They're facing pressure not just from the right, but also from the left and from their own considerations about what's good for their bottom line and what's good for attracting employees and customers. And the fact that you know that you have you get put in a position of sort of not being able to satisfy both sides is something that's uncomfortable, right, for businesses who want to keep as many people happy as possible. But it's not to me clear that they can do all that much about it. It just may be a fact of life for them for now.
Is this going to be something that many Republicans in the presidential primary are going to have to deal with? As they're going, it seems like everybody's sort of angling for this posture. Is this a lasting legacy that Donald Trump has left in the party, do you think?
I mean, I would expect it will be an issue in 2024, if only because Ron DeSantis seems to be running for president, and it seems to be one of his major, you know, one of his major planks in his platform as governor, and in his record as governor of Florida, is sort of fighting the war on woke, and it seems to be something that the conservative media really have devoted a lot of attention to over the past few years. And so I don't even know how much of it's about Trump. I mean, if Trump hadn't come along, maybe this would be happening anyway. Maybe it's just because of the changes in our country. But certainly, Trump getting elected as president led to a real cultural, you know, backlash on the left that really intensified this new progressive cultural sensibility among the people who didn't like Trump. So in that sense, yeah, certainly Trump, we can see it as part of Trump's legacy. And I would expect it will be something that Republican politicians you know, emphasize a lot, because I think their sense is it's a winning issue for them, especially in Republican primaries.
So the last couple of years have been interesting to watch. I think Democrats got much more done than people expected to. There was I loved your piece on this, that talking about how kind of it's been a little hyperbolic, right? We're comparing the last Congress to like the Great Society or the New Deal, which it you know it was a productive Congress, but let's just slow the roll a little bit. How would you put the last couple of years and his achievements in historical context? What do you think of them when you're thinking of legacy in terms of policy imprint?
Yeah, I think that you know, Democrats can feel pretty satisfied, but in part this is because expectations had sort of were never as high really for him as they were for Obama or Clinton, and so that in that way it's been easier for him to satisfy them. You know, a lot of this legislation, some of it seems quite, you know, sound legislation, but it's incremental. It's not a major trade. This is not the Great Society all over again. There's no single bill that he has signed into law that's even anything as big as the Affordable Care Act was. But there, I think he didn't have those big expectations either, because of himself as a figure was not as outsized as some of his predecessors, but also because everyone understood with the very narrow margins in Congress that there was just a limit to what you could expect this last Congress to do. And so it's like presidential primary politics, where if ev everyone thinks you're going to come in like, you know, fifth in New Hampshire and you come in third, then you can spin it as a big victory. Like
Right. Yeah.
it's somewhat the same. Like the expectations have not really been out of control, and in some ways it's been easier for him to satisfy them. And in particular, when people thought the second reconciliation bill was dead and then it came back to life, that got this huge, you know, positive, like people sort of went crazy because
Right.
of that, when, you know,
Everybody,
it
the
was all
Democrats are
because
taking back the House after they pass that thing.
Yeah, it was all because like everyone had left it for dead. So then it by comparison, it looked like this huge, amazing victory, maybe more than it deserved to be. So he's benefited from that. On the other hand, you know, he sort of needs to be. He's a guy who he didn't run and he didn't win on the basis of everybody just loves Joe Biden or everyone loves what he represents or stands for. He ran and won as I'm a guy who you're hiring to do a job. And one of the jobs was just to beat Trump, and he did that. But the other job was just to do the poli you know, sort of achieve the policy goals that Democrats wanted. And he's given them something. I don't know, you know, there's other things obviously that didn't happen that some of the interests and constituents in the Democratic Party will be disappointed that there hasn't been a breakthrough on immigration, that there hasn't been a Green New Deal, that there, you know, that some of the bills that did pass on climate change were not as big as they wanted them to be. And of course, we can expect the sledding to get a lot rougher from here on out now that the Republicans are in control of the House. But you know, he's kind of muddled through in a way that has left enough people satisfied enough that he's still standing, and assuming that he's ready to run for re-election, it would seem that he's going to have a pretty clear path within the party for a second term.
Yeah, that's it's kind of amazing that we're discussing his re-election, given the fact that there are all these rumors about one term and then like his age, and now it's just I'm not sure. I mean, I assume he's going to announce, and I assume he'll be the party nominee at this point. But yeah, how old will he be? 82 when he's running? 81?
Yeah, 82.
Well, that'll be up there. It'll be interesting to watch. Dave, you've been super generous with your time. Thank you so much for joining me today.
And, this has been really fun to chat with you, Josh. I really had a pleasure, and it was an honor to be here.
All right. Well, people will have to have you back on sometime soon.
Anytime.